This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
One so-called trial of the century?
We'll have to wait.
From APM American Public Media, I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, February 27th.
Coming up, state budgets look a little less gloomy.
And what is wealth, anyway?
Plus, should we shell out for Mars?
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
A federal judge has delayed the trial over the 2010 BP oil spill. The trial was set to start today, but the judge wants to give both sides more time to reach an agreement. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports there's a lot at stake.
Legal experts say this is shaping up to be the most complicated environmental case ever. It involves over 500 lawsuits seeking billions in damages and fines for the Deepwater Horizon blowout. Law professor Robert Virchik at Loyola University, New Orleans.
There are thousands of plaintiffs, hundreds of witnesses, 20,000 plus exhibits, and I'm told 70 million pages of reading.
Plaintiffs include everybody from the feds to fishermen. Damages could run as high as $50 billion, according to some analysts, Tulane law professor Ed Sherman.
And then there are civil penalties, and the Justice Department is pursuing those aggressively, and they could run $20 billion.
Sherman says the judge in this case doesn't want a repeat of the Exxon Valdez litigation that took 2 decades to resolve and wound up in the Supreme Court. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
For more on the trial, now we go to Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Good morning.
Hello, David.
So how important is this trial to BP?
Very important. It's a huge case, a civil case involving the federal government, the governments of the various states affected by the spill, and 116,000 individual claimants. These include fishermen and hoteliers who say their business was damaged by the spill. Chris Grabowski of Peak Oil Consulting says these are claimants who have not already benefited from BP's $20 billion compensation fund.
It's basically all these people who either refused to take compensation or weren't offered compensation, getting together with their lawyers to see what they can get out of it.
What are they trying to get out of it, Stephen? How much money is at stake?
Well, the sky's the limit. I mean, the critical question for the trial will be, was BP grossly negligent in the way it allowed the rig to be operated? If gross negligence is established, the penalties paid to the federal government alone could multiply by a factor of 6 or 7, and there could be exemplary damages awarded to the plaintiffs. This could cost BP tens of billions of extra dollars, which is why the company's been scrambling to settle out of court. We may find out how successful they've been if or when the trial begins next Monday.
So, David, there's at least one group of people who's not cheering for a settlement: hotel and office managers in New Orleans. In our Midday Extra today, we find out about the hidden stimulus of lawyers, hundreds and hundreds of lawyers.
Okay, so we've brought in a New Orleanian to discuss. Cress Gardner is the vice president at Transwestern, a commercial real estate company which has seen a demand for office space related to the trial. Morning, Cress.
Good morning.
So tell me about this. How is your business, commercial real estate, how is it being impacted by this trial?
We're finding kind of multiple impacts. We've had some long-term tenancies that are directly related to the lawsuit and the settlement, because hopefully that's currently going on right now, and also some very short-term uses for for groups taking 3 to 6 month leases to bring attorneys in and to provide various services that they need.
Now, how does it feel to sort of benefit from the spill in this way?
You know, that's a great question. I think ultimately, even if you ask the plaintiff side or the defense side, they ultimately need to get to a solution. And the way that this is going to happen is through either the trial or and ultimately a settlement to move forward for all parties that are involved. So I think it's just a natural part of the process. I don't really look at it as a question of whether we're benefiting from it or not. This is only a natural part of the process that must occur in order for this to move forward.
And we used the word stimulus in the introduction to you, Kress. I mean, there's that, right? There's some economic activity that wouldn't ordinarily percolate through your economy.
Absolutely. That is a benefit directly related to this. It wouldn't have occurred without the spill and the disastrous effects that it had. But, I mean, we certainly benefit as a whole from the legal industry here. We've had some other large litigation over the years since I've been here that the courts are a very important part of our business. Our attorneys make up probably over 45% of our tenant base here, which is by far the largest. We do love the legal industry here.
Now, what's your plan for all this space once this settlement happens and all these BP-related lawyers get out of town?
I think the overall economy here is improving. New Orleans has really become an entrepreneurial hub. A lot of the companies that started 2 or 3 years ago are really starting to grow and absorb space. So that's my biggest hope, is that we continue to foster that growth as a community and see these companies become larger and larger employers and ultimately consumers of office space.
But I got to know this before we go, Kress. Do lawyers spend their money to outfit these offices differently? I mean, what do these guys need? I suppose an internet connection, a telephone, and a whiteboard or something?
A photocopier, maybe?
You know, I'm not quite as familiar. You know, certainly once the deal is done and they have various service providers, I've heard some tales, of course, of people in the legal imaging business. That was one of the groups I was surprised they haven't hit. That's really an amazing amount of exhibits that are involved in this trial. Certainly some of them are leasing furniture on a short-term basis, or have, you know, brought furniture in from other locations depending on their needs. You know, so they're generally pretty Spartan in terms of their accommodations vis-a-vis kind of a permanent law firm tenant, but they're certainly consuming various services locally that filter through the legal services industry.
Thank you so much. Speaking about the paradox here of big trial that follows a disaster, how New Orleans is getting a lot of interest from lawyers coming in to cover the big BP oil spill trial. Kress Gardner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to Washington, where governors from around the country are meeting at the White House today. They're going to talk about job creation, better ways to work with the feds, and maybe how to spend some extra money. Tax revenues in most states have improved. John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
States point to different reasons for healthier tax collections. North Dakota and Oklahoma are reaping an energy windfall. Michigan is in the midst of a manufacturing turnaround. And then there are states riding a boom in the stock market. Scott Pattison is executive director of the National Association of State Budget Officers.
There's just so much taxation income coming in from basically the non-wage income, such as capital gains, investments, stock options, bonuses, things like that.
It's still too early to quantify, but Pattison expects April state income tax collections will be better than the last 3 years. Not back to pre-recession levels, though.
There's still not enough money to go around. I liken it to the family that may have had a slight boost in income, but the stack of bills on the other side of the table are higher than the amount they've received in the additional income.
States are still in a financial hole, he says, but at least the hole's not getting any bigger. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
More now in the markets, where in Europe earlier, the price of crude oil fell. That's wholesale, of course. Crude doesn't go well in your gas tank. And that's where we'll start this morning with Ellen Zentner, senior U.S. economist at Nomura in New York. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning, David.
So it's nice when the wholesale price of crude drops down below $125 a barrel in New York, but that is a lot higher than even a month ago.
Yeah, it's a lot higher, and gas prices, as you mentioned, have not fallen. And in fact, they tend to lag behind oil prices. So we've got probably, even if oil prices stay lower, a few more weeks of rising gas prices to come. And I just think the memory is still so fresh in our minds of gas prices at this time last year when they were rising and we ended up seeing a noticeable pullback in consumer spending in response.
What about all these headlines that are suggesting or worried about gasoline at $5 a gallon? It seems a bit overdone.
Well, you know, depending on where you live in the country, how far you are away from the source, how far you are away from available gas stations, you know, prices can vary quite a bit. It also, the taxes that each state charges varies the rate that you'll pay depending on where you live. So for the national average, we're a little bit still under $3.70 a gallon, but you are going to find places in the U.S. where gas prices are already reaching $5 a gallon. And of course, if the national average reaches $4, that tends to be that all-important psychological level that households really respond to.
Now, Lowe's, the big box hardware chain, had surprisingly strong profits today. Stock currently up about 1.6% as we're talking.
Yeah, you know, what's really helping Lowe's and other home stores is remodeling. Remodeling reached an all-time record high in 2011. It continues to climb. You know, with the housing market remaining out of favor, it's hard to sell your home. If you can't move and sell your home, you may as well make the box you live in better. And so remodeling has really benefited some of those large retail chains of home goods. And specialty contractors were a big source of job growth in construction last year as well. Specialty contractors specifically are tied to the remodeling business.
And apparently also the fine weather we've been having also encourage people to go to the hardware store. Ellen Zentner at Nomura, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, David, a gallon of gas will set you back 18 cents more than it did just a couple of weeks ago. And we wondered when those gas bills start changing the decisions we make. So we called up Alan Sloan. He's senior editor at large for Fortune magazine. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Adrian.
So put this gas price increase into a little context for me.
Okay, over the past year, gas prices have risen to the point where it's costing society roughly $55 billion a year more for gas than it did a year ago, and that's half the value of the cut in the Social Security tax.
Wow. So it's a lot of money.
Yeah, and it's money that is not available to be spent on other things.
So do people change their behavior when gas prices pop up the way they have?
Well, it depends on who they are. If there's someone like me who doesn't drive much, well, I don't really change my behavior. But if you're someone who drives a lot and you're living close to the financial margin, as unfortunately a lot of people are, well, then you do whatever you can to use less gasoline and lower your bill.
So how do gas prices affect our short-term decisions?
Well, if you look at gas prices, and it so happens, I'm sitting here with a table showing 20 years of gas prices.
Miraculously.
Amazing, isn't it? They bounce all over the place. A few years ago, they were half the price they are now.
Huh.
And people started buying SUVs again. Amazing how that works. Now, it's probably about the time where we're going to have all these stories, which will prove to be wrong, about people saying, I'm not buying any SUV, I'm going to buy an electric car, I'm going to do this to save money. And about the time everyone becomes convinced that's going to happen, gas prices will fall.
Yeah, and that gets to the next question, which is how do gas prices affect our longer-term decisions, like buying a car or maybe making our summer travel plans?
Well, again, it's the same situation where all things being equal, you'll buy a car that costs less to run than costs more to run if you think gas prices are going to stay high. And probably if gas prices don't fall dramatically in the next month, you'll start seeing a trend with people going to more gas-efficient cars, assuming they can afford them.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan, thanks.
You're welcome, Adrian. It was my pleasure.
And David, those rising gas prices, turns out they're at least partly responsible for a change in bathroom break policy in North Providence, Rhode Island. The mayor of the town wants city maintenance workers to go when they need to, where they are. According to the local paper, the Providence Journal, workers were actually driving all the way back to headquarters for their bathroom breaks. Instead, the mayor suggests a closer stop, like a fire station or maybe the library.
Thank you.
get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Today, Marketplace is launching a brand new beat.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
The Wealth and Poverty Desk will explore the growing concentration of wealth in the United States, its causes and consequences. Quite a mouthful there, so we're taking it one bite at a time. In the first of our stories about the fundamentals of wealth and poverty, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman says wealth is about more than just the dollars in your paycheck.
Nicole Lewis is 24. She lives in a spacious one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn on her modest salary at a New York nonprofit. She doesn't have a trust fund, but wealth is all around her, always has been.
My great-grandmother was the first Black woman to graduate from University of Pennsylvania Law School, the first to be appointed to the Pennsylvania Bar.
The family made money in law and business. Now they're in the top 1%. Lewis has gone to the best schools.
And I'm excited to break into the food world in New York City, which is a really tough, tough place to break into. It's all about who you know.
So she picks up the phone, calls her aunt.
She goes, great, we have a mutual friend. I'll reach out. I'll put you in touch.
With celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson of Red Rooster Restaurant, Harlem. Now Lewis has an internship at the top of the food chain.
And that ties into the way that I think about wealth and what it's meant. It's been more about entrance or acceptance into a specific social network.
Right place, right time, right people. Wealth lubricates the path to career and financial success for the rich. For the middle class, wealth is most important for the material boost that it can provide to the younger generation.
By giving financial assistance, for example, when they buy their first home.
That's Thomas Shapiro of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis. He says the biggest asset most families have isn't a stock portfolio or a business, but a house. Over time, the equity can be used for college, retirement, surviving job loss, or a bad accident.
Wealth is surplus security.
Meaning?
Think about everything that has value that you could possibly sell minus everything that you owe.
If that calculation puts you in the red, you don't have any surplus security at all. Turns out one in four American families have so little net worth they couldn't survive without income for 3 months at the poverty line. They're living with virtually no financial guardrail between themselves and destitution. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Mitchell at the Wealth and Poverty Desk looks at another fundamental question. What is poverty?
Now to Mars, if we can afford it. Mars researchers are meeting with NASA today to figure out if there's a way to pay for future trips to the red planet. Robotic missions in 2016 and 2018 have been cut from the president's budget proposal in favor of more human exploration and technology to keep an eye on the Earth. For more, we go to Olivier Devec. He's an astronautics professor at MIT. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. So why have these missions been cut from the budget?
So the overall picture is that NASA's budget has been very flat. So the budget request this year for NASA has been $17.7 billion, which is only $59 million less than last year. So this is primarily a redistribution of the budget between major categories at NASA.
So why does it matter whether or not we have robots going to Mars?
Of course, you could ask this question of space exploration in general, but the Mars rovers have really been a shining beacon, I would say, for gaining knowledge about the planet in the solar system that is most similar to our own Earth. And, you know, I don't want to paint a doomsday scenario, but maybe one day Mars will become a lifeboat for us. If Earth, for example, gets hit by a major asteroid, we might be very happy that we know a lot about the red planet.
Now, is there an organization that could be an alternative to NASA as far as getting this done?
Space exploration has now become a really, truly international endeavor. And, for example, the European Space Agency is quite capable and has a current mission on the books. And, of course, other nations around the world like Japan, Russia, and especially China are really stepping up their space exploration efforts. So we're certainly not alone. And you'll see more and more missions happening in a collaborative way.
Olivier Devec, thanks so much.
Thank you, Adrienne.
Speaking of people in the stratosphere, when Warren Buffett talks, people listen. But the 81-year-old billionaire isn't really talking about who will eventually replace him at the top of Berkshire Hathaway, his financial services conglomerate. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer now on a strange non-announcement.
You may be wondering why Buffett doesn't just say who'll replace him eventually. Well, analysts say that would cause uncertainty at Berkshire Hathaway. Big companies like to have a couple of people in the running. Len Blum is managing partner at the New York investment bank Westwood Capital. He says there are a few other reasons to leave the successor anonymous.
He's going to increase the public scrutiny on that successor, and if the successor leaves or makes a mistake, that's some risk.
Blum says Berkshire Hathaway shouldn't make a big deal of the succession issue and should even try to ignore it. Buffett couldn't ignore it this morning. He was on CNBC and, of course, was asked why he wouldn't say who'll replace him. He would only say the company knows exactly what it'll do when he can no longer run it.
It could be tonight. It could be 5 years from now. The board of directors knows exactly who the person is the next morning.
And Buffett pointed out that big companies like Coke and Amazon haven't announced who their next CEO is. But the thing about Berkshire Hathaway is Warren Buffett embodies the company, and he's headed it for almost 50 years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now to Europe, where some volunteer tax experts from Germany want to head to Greece for a series of tax collection how-tos. They say they'll hold workshops to help Greece increase its revenue as Athens grapples with budget cuts and austerity measures. Greek tax officials aren't happy with the idea. The BBC's Stephen Evan joins us from Berlin. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
So will these volunteers actually go to Greece and try to do something?
I think they will go. Some may go, but you can imagine the resistance, can't you? I mean, there may be some advice from governments outside about tax systems, about how to close loopholes and how to minimise illegal evasion. But there is not going to be, I don't think, a high-profile group of tax inspectors arriving from Berlin or Frankfurt and landing in the full blare of publicity and then fanning out saying, we've come to show you how to do it. There's a little bit of publicity going on in the German press, I suspect.
Why is this relationship between the Greeks and the Germans so fraught right now?
It's fraught because largely it's German money and it's German conditions put on that money. So all that austerity, people on the street in Greece are blaming on the Germans. The Germans, in turn, see on their television screens people, Greeks, in Nazi uniforms. And they think, the Germans think, hold on a minute, we're giving them the money, and now they're ungrateful. The German government, then, is very, very sensitive to that idea that it's starting to dictate terms, because Germany occupied Greece in the war, and there are people in Greece who remember the German presence in Greece and resent German conditions on their money.
The BBC's Steve Evans, thanks.
You're welcome.
And finally, I don't know about you, but one reason a fellow watches the Oscars is to get a respite from business news. Yet there was Billy Crystal last night making reference to the always hilarious United States bankruptcy code. Welcome to the Chapter 11 theater, he said as soon as he took the stage. It was one of those jokes where you kind of had to be there being the auditorium formerly known as the Kodak Theater. Back in 2000, Kodak paid $74 million for naming rights for the Oscar venue. Kodak was able to get out of that deal after it filed for bankruptcy last month. The plan was to say the Hollywood and Highland Center last night. Instead, Crystal called it the Your Name Here Theater. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.